Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Updates in the Standards of Care in Diabetes in 2023 with a focus on overweight and obesity. I am Diana Isaacs, an endocrine clinical pharmacy specialist and the Continuous Glucose Monitoring Program Coordinator at the Cleveland Clinic Diabetes Center in Cleveland, Ohio.
And I am Natalie Bellini, a nurse practitioner specializing in diabetes management with the R&B Medical Group in Williamsville, New York. Today, we're going to discuss the latest updates to the ADA Standards of Care in Diabetes for 2023, focusing on weight management and obesity treatment.
And to discuss more on this, we are joined now by Dr. Scott Kahan, the director of the National Center for Weight and Wellness. He is a member of leadership committees at the Endocrine Society, the Obesity Medicine Foundation, and the American Diabetes Association, where he serves on the Professional Practice Committee, which is the committee that creates the Standards of Care in Diabetes Guidelines. So we are so grateful to have Dr. Kahan with us today. All right. Well, we're so excited to have you with us today. To start, can you tell us a little bit about why has weight management become such an integral part of diabetes care?
Yeah, well, weight management has always been an integral part of diabetes care. Unfortunately, so many physicians and other healthcare providers didn't get the message perhaps, or didn't have the training necessarily to be able to put too much attention to it. But it's been a really good movement forward in just the last few years, and certainly in the last decade or two, where now you'd be hard pressed to find a healthcare provider that doesn't associate obesity and diabetes, and who doesn't attend to the importance of weight management and obesity. You know, they don't always know exactly what to do, and that's understandable. Because traditionally, obesity is not taught in medical schools, and it's given short shrift. But the focus has changed, the attention has changed, and I think we'll continue to see more and more movement making weight management and diabetes management almost indistinguishable going forward.
Wow, that's amazing. So. I think you're right. I think, though, that when we first started even screening for obesity in the chart, the BMI would pop up. It was a diagnosis code that came in, and you said discussed weight with patient, period. That's not really addressing weight at all, and I think that's what's happened in the past. And I think with the new medications out to treat obesity, there are other opportunities now, obviously. Can we talk about the role of genetics and social determinants of health in obesity before we jump into treatment?
Yeah. All healthcare providers appreciate that in most cases, underlying type 2 diabetes and underlying obesity are people's health behaviors, physical activity, what we eat, how much we move, and so forth. What people don't often appreciate, however, is underlying those health behaviors are a range of things that influence whether people will engage in them or not, and how successful they are in engaging in healthful behaviors. For one, genetics and secondarily biology plays a strong role in underlying what we do, how successful we are. And secondly, social determinants of health are really important. And so, for example, if you live in an area where there's minimal healthful food available, the few food options you have are, corner stores and bodegas, as opposed to large grocery stores that have lots of produce and other healthful options, it's going to be more challenging to eat according to healthful guidelines. If you live in areas where it's difficult to find safe places to be outside and be active, where it's not the norm to be playing in sports or being active outdoors or elsewhere, it's less likely that that's going to be a part of one's day-to-day life. And so many more examples of those, but genetics and social determinants of health are two really important things that underlie ultimately the things that we do for health.
So I'm curious, what's kind of the current consensus about staging or diagnosing obesity? I know, like, we have the BMI, the body mass index, but is that what's currently, is that what we're using? Or are there other kind of emerging ways to diagnose or classify?
Yeah, so so structurally, nothing on the ground has changed. Still, the most basic way of diagnosing obesity and secondarily determining treatment options is based on someone's size, i.e. their BMI. And you know, there's some benefit of that. It's quick and easy. You know, everybody knows what a BMI is. It's easy to calculate. We usually don't even have to do it. Our electronic medical records do it for us. And it's ingrained in our society and our healthcare system as the routine way of doing things. The problem, however, with that is there's lots of drawbacks of using BMI solely. For one, there's lots of misclassification. So on the one hand, someone who's very muscular will look like they have a high BMI, even if they're objectively thin and fit. And what's even more common is the opposite, which is to say people who are sarcopenic and osteopenic, people who are frail, tend to look like they have a healthy BMI, even though their fat mass is high and their risk from overweight, therefore, is likely high. That's one of many drawbacks of the BMI, of using BMI solely. Now, there's been a number of staging systems developed for obesity that allow us, in a sense, to try to stage the obesity. It's somewhat similar to how oncologists, for example, will use staging systems to stage a cancer, not just whether it's present or absent, but the degree and the extent and the severity of the cancer in that case, or of the obesity in this case. And it's largely driven by the presence of various weight associated comorbidities. There are a number of staging systems that have been developed, and they continue to be studied at length. And the studies show that almost exclusively, these staging systems are better ways of determining risk than just simply what a person's size or BMI is at baseline. Unfortunately, they haven't yet become standard in medicine. In practices like mine that focus exclusively on obesity, they're more common to be considered. But in a primary care setting, they're not frequently used. For now, I think that's okay. You know, as long as clinicians, in addition to BMI, consider patients' comorbidities and patients' weight-related health. So that includes comorbidities like diabetes and hypertension and sleep apnea and fatty liver and so forth, as well as functional status, you know, limitations on mobility, for example, and other ways that the weight may get in the way of the person's life and the person's quality of life. If we consider those things in order to better stratify patients beyond just the size, I think that goes a long, long way, even in the absence of using a formal staging system. I do, on the other hand, think that we'll see more and more consideration of use of staging systems over the next several years.
Well, I've had the great privilege to serve on the American Diabetes Association Professional Practice Committee with you over the last couple of years. And I know you've been integral to the whole obesity weight management section. So if you could tell us a little bit about what is new for 2023 in the standards of care regarding weight management and obesity.
Yeah, absolutely. The last few years, I agree, have been just wonderful serving with you and our other colleagues. And over the last few years, there's been a really nice progression in what we've been able to codify in these standards and share with the medical community. One thing that we've built over the last few years that we stressed, in especially this year, is that it's important to manage obesity as a chronic disease, one that's progressive typically, and often associated with medical, physical, and psychosocial complications. That helps to take clinicians away from just thinking about the patient in front of them as someone who's heavy and really needs to lose weight to fit more into societal norms, or to fit, you know, on paper into a healthier body mass index or a healthier weight status, and instead think about it in a broader way as a health condition that has lots of effects on the person's life. Often, and to work up those health problems and to work with the patient to try to be able to ameliorate those health problems and improve their health and their wellness. Secondly, we've further noted the importance not only of weight loss, but also, of course, of maintenance of lost weight. It's at least as important to be able to keep the weight off as it is to take the weight off. And that's especially the case when it comes to preventing diabetes and or managing and mitigating diabetes when it's present. So we spent a lot of focus on that. And then one of the biggest tweaks, if you will, this year has been the clarifying the importance of both smaller and larger weight losses as being potentially valuable. So one of the things we've known in the world of diabetes, of course, for many years, at least since the publication of the DPP studies, is that quite small weight losses, as little as 2 or 3 or 4 or 5% weight loss, can go a long way in terms of preventing diabetes and in terms of improving other modest health conditions and risk factors. But what we also know now, and we've had just a real explosion in data supporting this, is that while small weight losses are often very valuable and a little easier for people to wrap their heads around, especially when they have a lot of weight to potentially lose, larger weight losses are often more helpful and sometimes quite a lot more helpful. And so what we try to communicate in the standards this year is that clinicians should discuss with their patients the value of both smaller and larger weight losses, and then work to support their patients on how to go about putting that into place. For some patients, it's just not going to be realistic to aim for 10 or 15% weight loss, and that's okay, because smaller weight losses are still extremely valuable. And for them, it's a great goal to start with a lesser weight loss. And then later, you can aim higher perhaps. For other patients, particularly those with diabetes and particularly those with more significant diabetes, it will likely be even more valuable to aim for higher weight losses, if that makes sense in the context of the doctor-patient discussion with respect to weight. So that was another really important point that we tried to make in the standards this year.
Wow, that's amazing. And I think it really is. Some patients present and, you know, if you say to them, I need you to lose 15% of your body weight, and they weigh 350 pounds, it just becomes completely, and then they leave and they never come back. Right. And I think we've done that before in diabetes management. Your A1C is 12. You need it to be 6. Well, 10 was much better than 12 was, right? And the outcomes improve every time we drop it. I love the idea of saying to a patient, let's start somewhere. And I think that, I think, is going to improve our messaging to patients and to people with diabetes and people with obesity, right? I really do. I think it's a big improvement.
Yeah. So I'm curious, what are the different approaches that the ADA recommends to achieve and maintain weight loss for people with overweight or obesity?
Yeah, the ADA guidance is exactly analogous to the other published guidelines on obesity management. So while it doesn't have to happen in this sort of linear stepwise fashion, nonetheless, we often discuss it this way. It starts with healthful behavior and behavioral changes. So adjusting what people eat, their physical activity level, and in many cases, some relatively modest changes in health behaviors can go a long way in terms of improving risk factors, in terms of preventing diabetes, in terms of improving quality of life. However, in many other cases, either patients aren't able to achieve or sustain them, or the behavioral changes may not be enough to see the health benefits that are important to them. And so in those cases, we can escalate to more intensive, evidence-based, and often structured weight management programs. So that can be in primary care settings or in specialty settings. It usually includes a number of different types of counselors and specialists that patients are working with, such as physicians, such as registered dietitians, such as behavioral therapists, and other healthcare providers potentially as well. And that is, usually includes fairly regular, fairly intensive interactions between the whole range of healthcare providers, between doctor and patient, in order to support them to make more significant behavioral changes. And when that's insufficient, then we can escalate to FDA-approved medications for weight loss and often ongoing weight maintenance. And when that's insufficient, we can escalate to metabolic surgery. All of these have been shown to be effective on average, and different ones of these and different combinations of these may be more appropriate for different patient groups. And again, I just want to point out, I said this at the beginning of this answer here, I presented it as a linear stepwise fashion, but it doesn't have to happen that way necessarily. And it's not always most strategic for it to happen that way. Sometimes for people that have done lots of work on behavioral change and have met with dietitians and other specialists before and worked at it, even if you're seeing them the first time, it may be perfectly appropriate to escalate to use of pharmacotherapy even day one. Same thing with bariatric surgery, potentially. And similarly, it may be particularly strategic to utilize multiple of these strategies in combination rather than one and then the next and then the next. So that gets a little bit to the art of medicine. It gets a little bit to differences from patient to patient. But those are the general sort of categories of obesity treatment.
I really appreciate that because everyone wants an algorithm, and there are algorithms, but so much of it really is an art in taking in the individual patient characteristics. I am curious. So it's been very exciting with pharmacotherapy in terms of more agents getting approval and showing benefits in weight loss. There, of course, has been kind of also this Hollywood explosion about certain drugs and GLP-1 receptor agonists. And I'm kind of curious just to hear your perspective about that, about what's happening in Hollywood and kind of the increased use of these agents.
Yeah, it's been very upsetting to me what I've seen over the last 6 to 12 months regarding some of the newer medications. And most of what I'm reading, either in traditional media and certainly in social media, I think is bunk. On the one hand, people are saying that we finally have these magic medications. So for one, we've had really good medications for at least a decade. They're often underused, but they're very good. And some of the newer ones may even be better. But now we have a number of medications between the ones that have been on the market for a little bit and the newer ones. Second, these are not miracle pills. These are not miracle medications. In some cases, they have miraculous outcomes for some patients. In other cases, they don't work all that well for other patients. On average, they're pretty darn good, but ain't no miracles, unfortunately. Talk is about how they're terrible medications and everybody gets horrible side effects and everybody regains their weight. And that's just not true either. Yeah, you can get side effects, but most people don't. And you can regain your weight, but used appropriately and with good ongoing support and a long-term plan, most people don't regain their weight. And we could go on and on with this. Certainly, the idea of whether Hollywood people or anyone who doesn't have obesity, who isn't a clinical candidate for the medications, to be using it, whether to look good for a movie role or to, lose 5 pounds for, I don't know, the prom or, to put on their bathing suit on the beach, that's inappropriate. These are serious medications that are needed for people who have serious diseases. They're not things to be used, lightly. So you know, you can see I'm a little heated about what's been going on of late.
Well, I'm glad I asked. Yeah, it's great to hear your perspective about it. So it's, I don't know, I find it, I think a lot of people find it challenging when you have someone in front of you that has obesity or would benefit from weight loss. Like, how do you start that conversation without, you know, without offending the person? Any tips in that regards?
Yeah, I think there's a really straightforward, really quite simple tip that goes a long, long way here. And that is to essentially ask permission before diving into it. So, you know, tell the patient that, you know, you've been working together for some years and the weight has been increasing. And as such, the, you know, their blood sugar, their blood pressure has been increasing. And we know that there's lots of that frequently weight leads to lots of health problems. And so offer yourself as a resource and ask if it's okay to talk about weight and to work together on the weight in a matter of fact and an empathic way. And when you do that, on the one hand, most patients will greatly appreciate it and will be eager to get your help and your support. And for those people that don't feel comfortable with it, they'll know when they're ready that you're someone that they can come and talk to because you've treated them respectfully and thoughtfully by eliciting their opinion and what they need rather than just going in and telling them they need to lose weight and whatever. And lastly, it gives you a quick, easy way of shifting the conversation in that direction. Whereas otherwise it can be, you know, it can be easy to sort of fumble around with it. So I just think it's a really simple and real, and at the same time, somewhat profound way of starting a conversation.
I love that. So when a patient says to you, I'm not ready, I mean, you're different because you're in obesity as a specialty. They came to you for that fix, but I think in a, or that treatment, right? When a patient says no, a lot of times I'll say, you know what, we can address it at your next visit. You'll let me know when you're ready. And sometimes that, just opening the door, and last time we talked about, you know, I don't know, your postprandial blood sugars, your whatever, and weight, are you ready to talk about those today? What would you like to talk about today? And just continue to bring it up and say, I'm here for you. We can't push them to do it any more than I can push a patient to take mealtime insulin.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great key takeaway, ask permission. So we also see, you know, not just adults, but now a lot of kids and adolescents are faced with obesity as well. So any recommendations in terms of what we should do with this population to help them?
Yeah. So interestingly, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before. Yeah, yesterday, the American Academy of Pediatrics put out their newest guidelines, which largely mirror the adult guidelines, which is to say, certainly we need to be careful when using more intensive treatments for obesity, whether metabolic surgery, whether medications, but we should not shy away from those for appropriate adolescents and minimum adolescents. You know, I think that's a big, big shift that's going to take some time for a lot of pediatricians to wrap their heads around, a lot of parents to wrap their heads around. That's where things will likely go. It doesn't make it, you know, it doesn't mean, just as with adults, it doesn't mean that healthful behaviors are any less important. In fact, the healthful behaviors are at least as important. It's just that it's so hard for most of us to do them. And if after trying and trying and trying again, we have not been able to make much of a dent in the obesity and the weight-related health problems, then it's important to utilize the range of treatments that are available to us, regardless of the patient's age, and as long as it fits within, you know, appropriate guidelines.
Yeah. And I mean, it's been exciting to see, more drugs being studied in this population and showing benefits as well. So, well, I want to thank you so much. Thanks for talking with us today. I know our listeners will really benefit. So much great insight and wisdom. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
So I think one of the most important things that Dr. Kahan talked about was small weight loss goals and larger weight loss goals in our discussions with people with diabetes.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful because so often I see people come to me with this all or nothing thinking, like, well, I need to weigh what I weighed in high school. I need to lose 100 pounds. And that, wow, that's really overwhelming to approach it that way. But if you say, you know, let's aim for a 3%, a 3 to 5% weight loss, maybe that looks like 15 pounds, 10 pounds. All of that is meaningful and can improve outcomes.
I agree. I do. The other thing I think is important is his underlying messaging of it takes a team. You don't just get one thing. There, you know, he talked about this linear path discussion, but that no patient is person with diabetes is really linear, are they? So a patient might come in with that have already done some of the work, that have already tried certain things, and to start them back from the beginning is, again, it's just a blow. It shouldn't happen. We should be able to meet the patient where they are and say, okay, here you are along this journey. Let's start here. Let's work on this next. Let's do it from this point.
Right. I mean, I think of it as shared decision making, like laying out what are the different options. Of course, there's exercise and nutrition changes and bariatric surgery. There's a lot of medication treatments, and how it's shared decision making. It could look like a circle. I like how he mentioned the art of medicine, because often people, they come and they're like, what's the protocol? What's the treatment algorithm? And those do provide great guidance. But at the end of the day, people are individuals, right? And medicine really is an art. Right. And so it is about choice and shared decision making.
I think that if we practice medicine better in that alone, our outcomes will improve. I really do.
So another interesting thing about the standards of care this year is that even though, yes, like the 3 to 5% weight loss is great, that now they do mention, you know, even up to a 10 or 15% weight loss has additional benefits. And I think now with new therapies, you know, we have new data, for example, from tirzepatide, even though that's not FDA approved yet for weight management or obesity, we know, like, for example, from the SURMOUNT-1 trial, 20% body weight loss. So as these therapies are available and emerging, that really we can maybe in some cases realistically say, yeah, let's aim for that 15% weight loss if we can do it.
Absolutely, I agree. I also think that, again, we need to go back to our foundation. The patients that I've had using any GLP-1 that have lost the most weight tend to be those patients that are working with other healthcare professionals. They're working with a dietitian, maybe an exercise physiologist, maybe they have a support system in place. It's not just take your weekly injection and expect it all to happen. Occasionally we do see that, don't get me wrong, but most of the time it is a team approach. They're seeing a psychologist, they're seeing, you know, there's a lot to this. Obesity and overweight is not something that happened yesterday. It's happened over a long period of time, and things need to, you know, patients need to decide what's important, how they want to do it, and those other healthcare professionals, as a clinician, help me help the patient achieve what they're looking for.
I think that's a great point, that team-based care really is so important, because we are fighting against biology. Unfortunately, the body wants to keep its current weight. And so really to counteract all of that, using all the tools we have in our toolbox, but really taking advantage of the team, and as well as having, you know, a clinical psychologist or someone with additional behavioral support, having the dietitian, the nutrition therapy, having the pharmacist for medication management. I think all of that, we see that it leads to better outcomes when
Absolutely.
You have a team.
Right. I 100% believe in that.
So another thing that I really appreciated was when we asked, how do you approach a person about their weight? Because it can be, there's a stigma, unfortunately, associated with it, and it can be really hard. And so I think people have seen their team, their primary care provider, or other people on the healthcare team, and it could be no one's mentioned it for 10, 20, you know, plus years. And so I really liked that simple, just ask permission. Just ask permission. And the person says no, okay, but at least you tried. And you never know. I mean, it could be nobody's brought it up, so the person just didn't think losing weight was important or should be a priority.
And I think that when you and I think about going backwards towards diabetes and looking at data or talking to a patient about blood sugar management, it's the same thing. We ask permission before we start talking about our their blood sugar management? Can we look at, can we talk to you about some of your challenges? You know, that is something that, that we have taught other educators, taught other clinicians, taught other providers. I think that we now need to take that into another step, just like, and say, it's time to talk about weight. It should be addressed at every visit. And if the patient says no, then we respect that and say, okay, I'll write it in the note that you've chosen not to talk about it today, but we can address it in the future when you're ready.
Right. And another thing interesting this year about the ADA standards of care is that social determinants of health have continue to be more and more incorporated really into all the sections, including obesity and weight management. And I think it is important to address these underlying social determinants of health. Like Dr. Kahan mentioned, some people live in food deserts. They live in places where they cannot get fresh fruits and fresh vegetables. I mean, I've experienced driving. You go to certain places and they only have regular sodas. There's not even a diet or a low sugar option. And so what can we do to ensure better access to healthy foods, to being able to exercise and get physical activity? I mean, some people live in neighborhoods where it is dangerous to be outside. I mean, we live in cold climates where it's just freezing in the winter. And so there are real challenges. And so what can we do as a society to better overcome these?
I think that it is an ongoing challenge, and that it's going to person to person who presents in front of us. How can we help them achieve what they need? I know that there was a horrific shooting in Buffalo this year, and a racist shooting at a grocery store, and they have stocked refrigerators with free food now in the neighborhoods, and with produce, with milk, with you know, good for you foods that lots of the people that live in those neighborhoods could never afford before, and now it's free. Right? So an answer to a horrific, horrific challenge was, all right, we're going to bring this to them, right? I think that we all need to stop and look at what can we do to improve the lives of the people that don't have the advantages that others do.
Right. And speaking of that, I mean, we asked Dr. Kahan also about children. We touched upon that. But we are seeing that obesity is just increasing so much now in our children. And so, I mean, it begs the question, the causes, certainly social determinants of health can be at play. We know the food is not always the best. There's more processed food. I think kids may have more limited physical activity these days, but it's definitely, you know, it's a big issue in kids. Any recent developments in children?
So there are new guidelines, obesity management guidelines. And as Dr. Kahan mentioned, they're very similar to the guidelines for adults. So you, and again, is it, it's not linear, right? We have to find, where is this family? It's the family too. It's not the child. It's the family that we need to treat. And where is this family? What can we do to help? How do we address it? Because if you can't treat obesity, a child with obesity, and not treat the family, right? It's not going to work, right? So I think that there's a lot of work to be done in that. I do know that there have been, semaglutide was recently approved, a once weekly GLP-1 that is, you know, right now, before that, we had liraglutide, which is a daily GLP-1. And I know you and I are both parents. I can't imagine giving an injection to a child every day on top of the rest of the things we have to do, right? And obviously families with type 1 do it all the time. But it's another thing. It's another part of the burden. So I think that that will make things easier. But it's not the panacea. It's not going to be the panacea, right? We need to balance it with the support, just like it isn't for the adults, right? We need to balance it with the support of social work, of psychology, of dietitians, of exercise physiologists to help these kids.
Yeah. I do think it's good the American Academy of Pediatrics did develop a guideline, even though it is similar to what we see in adults. Hopefully it'll just get more on the radar in pediatrics so that we can address it. And hopefully we can also follow Dr. Kahan's advice in pediatrics about, you know, asking the child, asking the family for permission to be able to discuss this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the very rich and informative discussion. And thanks to our audience for tuning in. If you enjoyed the content, please subscribe to our e-newsletter to receive upcoming MedCast episodes and other great content in your inbox. We have so much more exciting things in store for you. In future episodes, we plan to talk about the ADA standards of care, the treatment algorithm, as well as psychosocial health and outcomes as well. And we'll also be talking about kidney disease and many other exciting topics. So please stay tuned.